Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello, and welcome to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest the author of an epic novel, The Glass Palace, published by Random House. The author is Amitav Ghosh. He is the author of several novels as well as works of travel and nonfiction. He has written for The New Yorker. Among his previous books are the novels The Calcutta Chromosome, The Shadow Lines, the nonfiction works In an Antique Land, and an essay on the use of nuclear energy in India, Countdown, a collection, Dancing in Cambodia at Large in Burma. And his concerns are largely with the meeting and separations of cultures and their constructive and destructive effects on one another. And so in The Glass Palace, we're watching Indians in Burma following the invasion of the British and the deposition and exile of the king and queen of Burma. And the book will take us through several generations. It will take us to America, to Malaya, to Bengal, to many different cities and economies and generations and thoughts. And so the book has several heroes. And it seemed to me interesting that each of these heroes seems to represent a generation's thinking about their relationship to culture, to their nation, and to industry. And I wondered if you would describe some of the evolution of some of the attitudes of the heroes of the novel.
Well, you know, I really think of the novel as having one, the central protagonist being... Well, twofold, really. One is Rajkumar, who's the central character, with whom the book starts in 1885 in Burma. He's a boy, and he happens to be present in Mandalay at the time of the British invasion of Mandalay. Rajkumar really, he sort of traverses, an almost circular path. He's an impoverished orphan. But he eventually sets out to make a huge fortune. And he does. And, I'm not going to reveal too much of, the rest of his career. But I think in the process, he has a very ambiguous relationship with what he does, And... in the end, Rajkumar is a person, to my mind, very much like many people who grow up in diasporas, which is that they essentially come to distrust the wider world, and all their hopes and beliefs really come to rest in their own families,
Well, the way I saw it, he arrives, he's dazzled by the pagodas of Mandalay, and he enters a kind of fairy tale. There's a fortress surrounding the glass palace where the king and queen live. He decides, orphan hero style, that he will penetrate that secret fortress. He falls in love. He wins, after years, one of the ladies-in-waiting to the second princess. But he sees the world as a dazzling place, and his model for what you do in the world is what the British soldiers have done. You take it over. You dominate it. You expropriate it. And so as he becomes a teak merchant and a rubber merchant and a transporter of laborers, it's as if his model is to be a British imperialist. He doesn't know this. I think the reader comes to recognize that he participates innocently in what subsequent generations will judge as being an imitation of his masters. This is his tragic difficulty, it seems to me.
Yes, there you're absolutely right. That is, in effect, that is the case. I mean, that is, he certainly profits from them, you know, the circumstances around him. But I think there is a sort of crucial difference for me, you know. I mean, that in the sense of his own intentions are solely, to protect his family, to give them, what he never had. To provide for his sons. And that, in some sense, is also his tragic difficulty, that he is participating in a circumstance, domination or whatever. And yet he's doing it for reasons which are internally, so to speak, different from the reasons that construct his world. I didn't feel that I wanted to be a didactic writer as such, and I don't think the novels have a sort of didactic purpose anyway. But I did want to write from a position where, yes, it is possible to look back upon the positions that these protagonists take, and to ask oneself, ethical and moral questions about what they're doing and what they did.
And also, mysteriously, to find affection for them as well, so that the revaluation doesn't simply involve blame or the sins of the fathers visiting the sons, but rather a recognition that we both inherit the past and start afresh simultaneously. I wondered, how comfortable did you feel with your ability when you started to evoke a world that you had never witnessed?
A very good question again. Yes, that's absolutely the case. I knew very little about Burma firsthand, you know. And really, it was only once I started writing this book that I went there and traveled there. So, yes, and I did feel that, I had to, in the form of the book, I had to make that explicit. So, which is why, in some sense, at the end of it, you do see that, this book is being written by someone who's outside the circumstance, as it were,
And not only that, someone whose own interests may be in the private and intimate details of life, now coming to grips with the necessity to tell history before it gets lost. This is Amitav Ghosh reading about the teak trade. It's the hero and his mentor traveling for the first time through Burma, watching the mining of teak.
Almost invariably, they would find themselves following the course of a chaung, a rushing mountain stream. Every few minutes, a log would come hurtling through the water on its way down to the plain. To be caught in midstream by one of these hurtling 2-ton projectiles was to be crippled or killed. When the path switched from one bank of the chaung to the other, a lookout would be posted to call out the intervals between logs so that the porters would know when it was safe to cross. Often the logs came not singly but in groups, dozens of tons of hardwood caroming down the stream together. When they hit each other, the impact would be felt all the way up the banks. At times a log would snag in rapids or on the shore, and within minutes a tangled dam would rise out of the water, plugging the stream. One after another, logs would go cannoning into one another, adding to the weight of the accumulated hardwood. The weight of the mass would mount until it became an irresistible force. Then at last something would give. A log, 9 feet in girth, would snap like a matchstick. With a great detonation, the dam would capsize, and a tidal wave of wood and water would wash down the slopes of the mountain. Chaungs are the trade winds of teak, Sir John liked to say. In the dry season, when the earth cracked and the forests wilted, the streams would dwindle into dribbles upon the slope, barely able to shoulder the weight of a handful of leaves, mere trickles of mud between strings of cloudy riverbed pools. This was the season for the timbermen to comb the forest for teak. The trees, once picked, had to be killed and left to dry, for the density of teak is such that it will not remain afloat while its heartwood is moist. The killing was achieved with a girdle of incisions, thin slits carved deep into the wood at a height of 4 feet and 6 inches off the ground, teak being ruled, despite the wildness of its terrain, by imperial stricture in every tiny detail. The assassinated trees were left to die where they stood, sometimes for 3 years or even more. It was only after they had been judged dry enough to float that they were marked for felling. That was when the axemen came, shouldering their weapons, squinting along the blades to judge their victims' angles of descent. Dead though they were, the trees would sound great tocsins of protest as they fell, unloosing thunderclap explosions that could be heard miles away, bringing down everything in their path, rafts of saplings, looped nets of rattan. Thick stands of bamboo were flattened in moments, thousands of jointed limbs exploding simultaneously in deadly splinter blasts, throwing up mushroom clouds of debris.
Amitav Ghosh, reading from The Glass Palace. Now, as I read that passage and neared its end, and I came to mushroom clouds of debris, suddenly I stopped and realized, oh, we know where mushroom clouds more famously come from. And then I looked back over the passage to see that while it begins factually, gradually the trees are assassinated, the men are their killers, and by the end even more enormous intimations of global destruction are suggested. And then we see that the felling of the trees not only involves the killing of men who are attempting to harness them, but the tree falling brings down much more, a whole system, so that eventually, symbolically, the British, removing the teak, are destroying a system of life and predicting the arrival, which will come by the final sections of the book, of mushroom clouds. And I found that details large and small throughout the book were the author's intimations of the vastness of a system that only people are small cogs in the wheel of a process that we can only see from afar, from an author's perspective.
Well, Michael, I must say it's wonderful to have a close reader. it's a lost art now. Because certainly that's absolutely the case in this passage. I mean, I think, you know, throughout these passages, and again, you know, in the later passages about rubber planting in Malaya, you'll see the same thing, perhaps. There is absolutely that. I mean, this whole sort of duality of, you know, building these great enterprises upon the absolute destruction of the earth.
I think that the origin of this kind of writing is in Tolstoy and in Melville. The creation of what looks like informational detail that is also interpreted detail, a way of looking at history, at business, at structure. And I wondered, what were your relations to models like that, the sections of the Bible in which we're told how the tabernacle was built, or the sections in Melville in which we learn how oil is extracted from whales, both of these in their way being descriptions of imperialist projects?
I mean, Tolstoy has forever been a great inspiration for me, but most of all Melville, really. Moby Dick, you know, in many ways is absolutely the model for, you know, for what I was trying to do here. You'll remember that wonderful passage where he says, it's the beginning of a chapter where he says, people say that the whale is a mammal, but the whale is not a mammal. It is a fish, you know. His absolute involvement, you know, in the informational aspects that make that world. I feel a complete commitment to that, really. I mean, I really do feel that, you know, when we look upon the world, there has been, you know, there's a tendency today, especially in novels, where really there's a kind of almost exclusive concentration upon the self and upon, you know, selves and a very sort of limited number of selves as well, without, as it were, the context, the wider world, the history around it, and really the connection between, you know, the people and the earth, as it were, you know.
Because I saw this book as constantly about the construction. How does an author construct the past? Does he see large things or small? Does he see individuals or masses? Does he see history or days? And that seemed to me to be a very difficult set of procedures to reveal to a reader gradually.
It is very difficult. Absolutely. It is very difficult. It's also because, you know, conventions of reading change, you know. You know, that fact that we all know to be the case, that, you know, a novelist in his novel gives you, you know, what is of interest to him, you know, or what makes sense within the covers of his book. You know, in some way, a reader often seems to expect that every aspect of time will get equal coverage. But of course it won't, you know. I mean, there are moments in time which are greater than or more significant than others. And that is what the novelist necessarily concentrates on.
You know? I'm speaking to Amitav Ghosh, the author of the epic novel The Glass Palace, published by Random House. Now, what were the moments of time that you found most accentable in this novel? What were the places that you were writing toward and away from?
To begin with, the defeat of the King of Burma, you know. Because in many ways this seemed to mirror so completely, you know, a process which is not over, you know. We see it repeated, you know, in the late 20th century so many times. That is, you know, enormous technological weaponry brought to bear upon, you know, places which really have no ways of resisting, you know, that accumulated firepower. And, you know, 1885 in Burma was really in some ways like that, you know. I mean, of course, there had been many predecessors to that. But the king's defeat, his removal to India, and finally his life in India, you know, I came to be really very, very much moved by the plight of the king and queen of Burma, you know, his 27 years of captivity in India, his death in India, because, you know, he responded to his circumstances, I think, with great dignity in a way, you know. It really was the case that, you know, when they took the king away, it was the deliberate idea of dismembering the indigenous Burmese system of politics, you know, of really sort of destroying the Burmese state as such, because they knew that, you know, the king would become the focus of national resistance. So they just put the king away. They wouldn't even allow photographers to visit. You know, it's such an extraordinary thing that even after Burmese independence, you know, after Burma became an independent country, they wanted to have King Thibaw's remains taken back to Burma. And the British High Commission in Burma protested vigorously, saying that this will create anti-colonial sentiment.
Yes, their awareness that the people love the king and queen even yes. in their despotism, and that therefore they must not be allowed to remember them because That's memory right. will foment rebellion.
Absolutely.
That's
absolutely.
The subject of this book in a sense.
That's right.
The invisible subject.
That is absolutely right.
That you are, as an author, embarking upon a journey through your father's memories so that the silence that they've been held in previously
yes.
that permits colonialism can be broken. And the book is, in a sense, a recognition that memory fosters anger and anger rebellion.
I would say that, to me, really one of the sort of, the central sort of issue of the book in some way is that of complicity. You know, the complicity of Indians, particularly the complicity of Indians within the imperial project. Because, as you know, I mean, in the opening section when we talk about the invasion of Burma, in fact, that battle was won by Indians, you know. I mean, two-thirds of that army was Indian. Two-thirds of the British army was Indian. And, you know, subsequently, when I started researching this history in greater detail, of course, I discovered, as anybody looking at Asian history discovers, that throughout the late 19th century, the British used Indian soldiers to put, you know, A, to annex new territories, B, to put down rebellions, often very, very violently, they were involved in the Boxer Rebellion, Indian troops were involved in the Boxer Rebellion, and hundreds of minor rebellions across Asia. So, when one notices that, and when one also notices, for example, the position that Mahatma Gandhi took, which he took consistently along with, Jawaharlal Nehru and all the other important, really major moral figures of modern India, they always said quite explicitly that imperialism is the progenitor of fascism, So it struck me that, I want to pose this question with the full moral weight with which we pose the question about collaboration with fascism, that we have to pose the question of a collaboration with imperialism.
I'm speaking to Amitav Ghosh about his novel, The Glass Palace. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm. I want to talk to you about what, then, you take the role of the novelist to be.
It's one of the unacknowledged elements of fiction, that fiction does address issues of ethics. I mean, it almost invariably does. And we see this, for example, the absolute centrality of, say, a Holocaust fiction, if you like, in our world, really, that is what it is doing. It's really interrogating, ethical positions. And if you look at the whole body of, let's say, Second World War literature, it does often interrogate precisely those ethical issues. People like to say that these are political issues, everything is politics and that's what we're looking at. But I think, in fact, they're wrong. It's not politics that this kind of fiction is examining. It's ultimately issues of ethics.
The Glass Palace by my guest Amitav Ghosh ends in a rather extraordinary way, given our conversation. Mm-hmm. We have witnessed the statement in the book of a Burmese writer that she believes that writing, classical writing, takes place outside the house, in the fields of history and courtyards and courtrooms. In the last paragraphs, the narrator describes something he's seen. And I'll let you describe it, because it is quite in contrast to the idea of the outside larger planes. He describes it as one of the most moving things he's ever witnessed.
Well, it's really, two of the characters, Rajkumar and Uma, who are then in their 80s, finally finding each other, as it were, in a moment of privacy.
What does he see?
Well, he sees them making love.
Yes, but I want you, in fact, there's a detail, and you know what I mean. They don't have their teeth in.
That's right.
And the first thing that makes him aware that they are in an intimate relation with one another and not just in bed next to one another is that their dentures are in the same glass. And one of them reaches for his teeth, puts them in his mouth, but the other set of dentures are entangled in. And the other, the woman, puts her dentures in by essentially kissing the dentures of the first. And so what we've seen are two old people who begin a kiss by an operation involving the dentifrice. The young boy, the great-great-grandson?
Yes.
Is there in the room. He is the novelist, and he sees this after he's presented this great epic, this moment of insertion of false teeth and a kiss occasioned by it as the most moving moment of all. And I wondered if you could talk about that.
For me, in many ways, this is a book about defeat, It's a book about, the defeat of cultures, the defeat of individuals. And yet, it's about the completeness of defeat, you know, that within circumstances of defeat, people discover moments of joy, of happiness, of, you know, pleasure and delight and, you know, all those things. They do exist within, you know, a circumstance where people are learning what defeat is and finding, you know, what it means. So in some sense, for me, really, that resolution really does, because, you know, really does come to the heart of actually the whole idea of the book. Because in that moment of private intimacy, they really do rise above, you know, everything that they've suffered. I mean, Rajkumar at this point is a man who's lost everything, you know, who's lived through so many multiple defeats, you know, and yet here he does still have the humanity to make that final connection with an old enemy.
Well, it's not only that, it seems to me. Without their teeth in, they can't speak. The book has been so much about who can speak and who can, where does the voice, the story of these people, where will it be told? Where will it come from? They put in their teeth, but they put in their teeth to kiss. So again, they're not speaking, but they facilitate the speech of the novelist. It's almost as if what we see in these final pages is an inheritance that says, you talk.
Well, that's a wonderful reading. That's a wonderful reading, and I'm thank you. And I think you're right.
Well, it seemed to me that if in the opening sections of the novel, the book is about the penetrating of the forbidden palace and the opening of a secret door, the end of the novel reflects that again. Suddenly, the novelist, the great-great-grandson, is opening a door and witnessing an act of love that would have been forbidden years before, forbidden to writing years
That's right.
before,
Exactly.
and that this is part of the new destiny.
That's absolutely the case, absolutely the case, because so much of the novel is actually about intimacy, you know. It's about love, it's about intimacy, and it's about the deceptions of intimacy even. And exactly that, and, you know, there again you have it. I mean, you know, we are reconciling two kinds of histories, histories of intimacy and histories of the world.
I've been speaking to Amitav Ghosh about his novel, The Glass Palace, published by Random House. I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm, and thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Michael. It's been a great pleasure.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Mario Diaz. Special production assistance from Alan Howard with J.C. Swadek. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse. Book time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.